We'll call this evening's meeting of the Southern Nevada District Board of Health to order. We'll begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. If you can please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Do we do the presentations then before we do adoption of the agenda?
And before we do that, just for the record, we've been appropriately noticed.
We'll turn the time to Dr. Madoff.
Well, Winston Churchill said success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And I'm delighted to be here tonight so that we can recognize some great successes from our public health heroes for 2013. So I'm going to ask the nominator of our awardees to come up and introduce and say a few words about each of the three groups that we're going to recognize for their service to the community and public health tonight.
Hi, I'm Jane Shani, the manager of the Office of Public Health Preparedness, and this is Jeff Quinn, one of our senior planners. When the invitation came from the Public Information Office to nominate a candidate for a public health hero, it was a unanimous decision in the Office of Public Health Preparedness to nominate Sergeant Dan Lake. I'm going to let Jeff give him a few compliments.
So I have the pleasure of serving and working with Sergeant Lake. He meets many of the criteria that we have for public health as far as nominating a hero. He meets four of the 10. And most notably, some of the most important things he does is educates our community in collaboration with us on public health preparedness, as well as he's instrumental in training our workforce in public health preparedness with incident command. And I know many of the board members have attended Dan Lake's ICS 300 and 400 training. So he's integral with really working with us to exercise many of our preparedness plans, and allows us the opportunity to collaborate on joint exercises, really planning and preparing for those activities we hope we never really have to experience in real life, but it builds up community capacity for that. So with that, I'd like to welcome Sergeant Dan Lake with North Las Vegas. And
a few words. You know, it's truly is an honor to be here today, and it's not about me. It's about teamwork in this valley, and I believe there's no place in the United States that prepares more collaboratively than Southern Nevada. And it's just been my honor to work with such great folks from the Health District, from Metro, Mesquite, Henderson. We're a great team in the South, and if anything happens, we're ready. Thank you very much.
You have pictures?
Well, we can think we are. We can think we drilled ourselves into readiness.
Make efforts.
Program coordinator for the Southern Nevada Health District's Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. When we received our grant to address the issue of teen pregnancy, Nevada was fourth in the nation for teen pregnancy. And We selected two partners, Clark County Juvenile Justice and Clark County Department of Family Services, to partner with us and to give us access to teens. And I want to say that since, in the 2 years that we have been partnering, they have done everything possible that they can do to assist us and to work with teens to really address the issue of teen pregnancy prevention, which is a significant public health issue. And I just wanted to recognize Jack Martin, who is the Director of Juvenile Justice, Paula Hammack, who is the Assistant Director of Department of Family Services, Judy Tudor, who is the manager, and even in her own grant, incorporated teen pregnancy prevention into what she was doing in her agency. And Pamela Kurz, and one of the best leaders I have ever come in contact with, is Mr. Dean Steiner from the Stewart Probation Center. So I just want to recognize everybody here for the incredible work that they have done in assisting us and making our success, our program a success. We have reached over 1,300 youth in the 2 years that we have worked together. So I want to thank you all.
Does anybody want to say a word?
Thank you so much for this recognition. It's such an honor to be able to partner with the Southern Nevada Health District in addressing teen pregnancy, specifically for us at Clark County Department of Family Services with our foster youth. We were privileged enough to receive a grant from the federal government, and based on the initial work that we had done with the Southern Nevada Health District, we decided to target teen pregnancy in our foster youth. And so now we're working in a community partnership with several other community partners to really address this issue, and we're so grateful for the recognition and just the opportunity to collaborate. So thank you very much.
I just want to thank Michelle for the opportunity to reach out to us to collaborate on this exciting adventure, and she's done a wonderful job, and it goes to show you that if we could collaborate more between multiple departments, we could do great things. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Michelle and her team as well. They've really made this process seamless, very easy to reach at-risk probation kids, kids who aren't really good decision makers anyway. And we've provided them with some knowledge and skills and to build positive, healthy relationships and hopefully, you know, prevent unwanted teen pregnancies. So I really appreciate everybody's efforts on that.
I'd like to echo everybody else's comments at the table. Michelle, it's very easy to collaborate with people that are so passionate about things as natural as protecting our children and doing good things for our children. So you know, with that approach and Michelle's passion and her team's passion for wanting to work with our children, you know, I just have to reach out and say, well, we're getting the award. I think it might be misplaced, at least for me. I think, Michelle, you probably deserve it far more than I do for your day-to-day work in keeping our kids and our families safe here in Clark County.
And I'd like to thank her on behalf of community providers. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be able to partner with these agencies on the behalf of the children that we work with. Thank you.
She's good.
alternate. I'm an alternate. Right?
Hey, Lauren, it's pretty good. How are you doing?
Absolutely.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Ezra Tuwig, and I am a health inspector from the East office. I would like to recognize Ms. Linda Lopez from HMS Host, McCarran International Airport. Ms. Linda Lopez is very proactive, very strategic, and she's a very good educator. Before the 2010 regulations, new regulations came out, she already had a head start and jump-started the development of the protocols and the internal procedures for the airport. McCarran International Airport being one of the busiest, top 10 busiest in the world, and in the United States alone, that really says a lot about her. And she also teaches ServSafe classes. She's always supportive of all her employees, very compassionate and very firm at the same time. So I would just like to say that with what she does, she definitely makes me feel like my work in the long run doesn't go to waste, and that it's possible to build a great relationship between industry and what we do because of her level of proactiveness and strategy. So I would like to recognize Ms. Linda Lopez from HMS Host.
I'm so happy and I'm so honored because the health department has been such a blessing to me. They're so supportive. They're always there when I need them. And I can't say enough. I'm so happy. Thank you so much. This is a great honor for me.
Thank you. It's wonderful to make these presentations and honor these public heroes. It shows the importance of collaboration and working together for public health. Thank you for making the effort to honor them, and congratulations to the honorees. Anyone else have anything? Comments? Then we'll proceed with our meeting. We'll begin with public comment. We have a limited to 5 minutes per speaker if we have anyone who wishes to speak.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm sorry I missed the last meeting for on behalf of Dr. Coleman for the CHO Succession Committee. But I sound like a broken record, and I'm really very sorry. However, it's because I'm very, very passionate about Dr. Coleman. And I'm really, really kind of frustrated. I mean, how much money and how much time are we going to spend to put this man in or get another CHO? He's a great guy. He's the best man for the job. And when I was watching that horrible attack on in Boston, I kept thinking, oh my God, you know, here's Dr. Madad doing the best he can in the interim, and we're doing all this stuff to get prepared if anything like this happens. Well, you know, Dr. Madad, in all honesty, is getting ready to retire here, and he would like to, you know, hand over the torch and to hopefully Dr. Coleman and get everybody squared away. So I know Dr. Coleman's not here, but I'm here for him, and I hope that the board decides soon because the employees and the managers and everyone here wants to get moving and get on with business, and we need to know who our leader is and to support him. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else who wishes to speak?
Hello, my name is Jose Vasquez at 6360 East Sahara Avenue in Las Vegas, Nevada, 89142. Well, my comment is as follows. I had the chance to be in one of the hearings for one of my friends and client too. What I do here in Vegas since 2002, I do bookkeeping and accounting. So when Daniela approached me back in 2005.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. This item is not on the agenda. This is better left for the second public comment period.
Okay. If we could ask you to wait until, this is for items that pertain to our agenda. So if you could wait, we have a public comment at the end of the meeting.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll proceed. If there was one change to the agenda, item 2 in section 7 actually belongs in our report discussion action. So if we could move 7-1 to 6-2. Or do I have a motion with that change for adoption of the agenda?
So moved.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Very good. We move to the consent agenda. And we have the minutes with three petitions that can be taken together unless someone, in a memorandum, unless someone has something that they would like to move separately.
I'll make the motion to approve the consent agenda as submitted.
Okay, we have a motion for Mr. Noonan.
Second.
Second from Councilwoman Woods. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. So now we move to public hearing in action. And again, this is for speakers on our public hearing or action items. Do we have anyone who wishes to speak at this time? Seeing none, we move to item number 1, section 4, memorandum 01013.
Good evening, Rory Chetlett, Southern Nevada Health District's EMS and Trauma System Manager, here to present our about biannual review of our EMS regulations. We look at these about every 2 to 3 years. We take them out to the community. They're vetted through public meetings, public hearings. We also take them to our medical advisory board. So this has been about a 6-month-long process. In your packets, you should have our summary of changes, and we try to make it easy to read for you. So the major changes are highlighted in yellow in your summary of changes. And I can go through this at whatever pace you'd like, whatever you're comfortable with. If there's any specific questions, I can address them. Or I can just hit a few of the highlights. It's at the board's discretion how much time you'd like to spend on them. So,
should we start with highlights, and then if we have further questions, if that's agreed upon?
Not a problem. At the global changes, we've just made some minor housekeeping changes, such as our name change. We added EMS and Trauma System Office, an abbreviation for that. We have added advanced practitioners of nursing throughout the document for the ability to sign off skills. We've allowed nursing and doctors to do that. Now we're allowing APNs to do that. Just some other minor language changes where we've separated some wording, which is fairly common. Things change in how we use them. In section 100, if you remember back in January, we had a variance. There was some question about the term field experience. So we've actually defined field experience. So we won't have that problem again in the future. And again, just stop me if there's any specific questions that you want me to cover more detail on. We defined patient. Patient's a difficult thing for EMS to really know what is a patient because of the function that EMS does. So we've actually worked on this for several years now. So we've actually come up with an agreement through our EMS QI Directors Committee, which is a subcommittee of our Medical Advisory Board. They've defined patient. So we've put that new language in. Definition about a public health emergency, and I'll talk about a little bit more when we get down a little further into this. Under Section 200, we have noticed that we've had one agency change ownership, significant ownership in one of our programs. We didn't have any language in there about requiring them to resubmit an application and resubmit those kind of changes to us. So it's one of those things we missed. We've corrected that. Section 400, this is something that we've had a problem with for several years now. More and more of our agencies are required to have, individuals are required to have a physical examination before they work in EMS. They've been taking them out to APNs and PAs to have those physical exams done, and by regulation, we only allowed an MD or a DO. We recognize that PAs and APNs could do those physical exams, so we're asking to make that change to allow APNs and PAs. That'll be a big convenience to our health or our providers out there to be able to get a cheaper physical exam, but yet just as thorough of a physical exam. 400.050, language in there had been in there for quite some time, the word shall versus may. In that particular section, when you use the word shall, our interpretation would be if the individual completed the entire process of applying, we would have to give them a license, regardless of the perhaps the outcome of what we found on the application. So we changed that from shall to may. Gives us a little bit more flexibility on whether or not we find anything in the application we don't like, we don't have to grant them the application. So it seems like a minor word change, but really is significant in its meaning. Also added in section 400 about licensure. Licensure applies only while the individual is employed. We didn't have that very specific language in there, so we've added it now. So the individual has to stay employed with a permitted agency to maintain their license. In section 800, the most significant change there, and it was, we've had language in there that goes way back into the 70s, when ambulance companies were first starting in Clark County. And we had decided a long time ago that we should set some minimum staffing of basically the depth of the bench is the best way to look at that. And we said that they, for the first ambulance, they would have to have 5 paramedics and 3 other attendants. And it's really a business decision. And we've determined that that's really not the health district's responsibility. Our responsibility is to make sure that when that ambulance or that fire truck rolls, it's appropriately staffed with 2 attendants at the appropriate levels. So it's really a business decision how deep your bench has to be. So we've removed that language from section 800. In sections 900, 1000, and 1100, we've cleaned up the language allowing these individual programs, permitted agencies, to make sure that they meet the requirements for Nevada's Commission on Post-Secondary Education Requirements. So they are allowed to train their own individuals, but if they start to train outside of their own individuals, they have to meet post-secondary requirements. So we've just cleaned up that language in all 3 of those sections. So that's the private ambulances, the air ambulances, and the fire departments. And under EMS administration, we just put in some language now because most of the agencies are using electronic records. That hadn't really been addressed. We only talked about written records, so we've put in some language to allow the use of electronic record reporting. And then this next section, 1300.900, if you remember several years ago when we had the H1N1 scare, the rest of the state was in a panic about how they were going to provide immunizations across the state. EMS providers are currently not allowed to do, or were not allowed to provide immunizations. It would have taken a declaration of an emergency and a state health officer to step in and do certain things. So in the last session, the NRS was changed to allow the ability for EMS providers to be used during a public health declared emergency to provide immunizations if needed. So we put that enabling language into our regulations so it mirrors what's in the NRS. That would still take a state declared emergency, an emergency declared by the chief health officer, and then they would be trained up for that particular emergency to respond. Likelihood of us hopefully ever having to use that here is pretty slim, but we now have the enabling language in there to do that. And then under our medical advisory board, recommendations that came out of our American College of Surgeons consultation was to add the a person on the trauma side to this. So we've added the chairman of the regional trauma advisory board will now become an active member of the medical advisory board, so we get more cross-pollination of ideas between the two programs that basically help to guide us. And also we've had our EMSQI directors committee meeting for decades, and we never really had enabling language in the regs to allow them to do that. So we've found that, and we've added that enabling language so that they can function properly within the boundaries of the NRS. And I believe that's it for the highlights. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to go back and answer any that you might have on any of the sections.
I'll move to approve.
I have a motion to approve. Do we have any discussion? Seeing none, do we have a second?
A second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Here's your pass. Thank you. That was needed and well done changes. Thank you. Our next item is closed session, if we can.
Oh, we have another
variance. Oh, that's
variance.
Right. Variance. It's not on the.
It's not on our.
Oh, it's not in.
It's on the blue. It's on the blue, but it's not on the.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Right.
Susan LeBay, Environmental Health Supervisor. Before you is a variance for the water park, which is going to be called Wet n Wild. This is a very similar variance to what was granted 2 months ago to the Cowabunga Water Park, which is the other water park that will be opening this summer. The recommendations that staff have made are the following: that the petitioner agrees to increase the number of sanitary facilities should the health district or the health authority determine that the current facilities are inadequate. Indicators for inadequacy are the patron wait time, the sanitary conditions of the facilities, as well as the sanitary conditions of the water. Petitioner also agrees to increase the number of sanitary facilities. The shower heads will be increased within 1 week. The restroom facilities will be increased within 1 year. During that time, they will limit their capacity to 1,500. Should we determine that it is necessary for us to limit their capacity based on the reduction of fixtures that they have asked for. And that they will be in compliance with all other portions of the regulations.
Very good. Questions? Comments? Mr. Jones?
So this will bring us into similar to the other water parks that have come before us, and we'll have some consistency. And
they're very consistent in their numbers. The difference are the types of facilities. The water park that's going to be going into Henderson will have more family style stalls or more family fixtures. However, this water park will be providing more urinals and restroom type facilities, but they're very much in line with each other now on the numbers of fixtures that they will be providing to the public. And of course, as we have talked about with the other water park, the inspectors will be out there on a very regular basis this summer to ensure that we do have enough fixtures out there. And both water parks did agree to reduce their capacity should that become necessary.
Madam Chair. Councilwoman Wood.
And I apologize for whatever reason I can't find it here to pull it up, but I know when I was reading it ahead of time, my only concern was it was talking about like a 20%.
It is a 20%. I will say that it is in line with what industry standards does across the U.S.
Okay.
In my research, I contacted probably about 20 other water parks throughout the U.S., and their numbers are very similar to what I was seeing at the other water parks for 3,500 capacity on a daily basis. They were right in line with that. So we're certainly willing to give them the chance at it. They're certainly under the understanding that if it is not adequate, that they will have to add additional facilities.
Okay, so it's less than what we typically require.
Absolutely.
But you're saying it is in line with what the common industry is doing at this time.
Outside of our state, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
How do you measure whether or not what they put in is effective?
We have three different indicating factors. However, we can use any indicating factor. The three that we have chosen to put into the variance itself is that if the wait time is longer than 3 minutes, if the sanitary conditions within the restrooms themselves cannot be maintained, or the sanitary conditions of the water or the bodies of water cannot be maintained, those are the three major indicating factors that would require us to reduce or limit their capacities. As long as those three things can be maintained, we're willing to allow them with the reduced fixture counts.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Who did we have down? Councilman Beers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the same question I asked you the last time we had this variance, which was what we're doing to, and just for the record, if you'd repeat, what we're doing to bring our regs in sync with the national standard that's developed.
Currently, we are working on that. The Model Aquatic Code is something that we are looking at. We have actually compiled it, and we are now starting to go through it and see how we can adjust it to our needs here within Southern Nevada, or as well as the state. We work under a state law. If we have to adopt our own local regulations, we're willing to do that. We would like to see it actually adjusted at the state level as well. 95% of all commercial bodies of water sit in Clark County, so we are really, truly the monopoly on that that type of facility. So it makes sense that we would bring the code forward.
And is this proprietor going to restrict the number of sodas that somebody can drink over the course of a day?
I think that's more up to New York. They like to restrict the numbers of sodas you could have or the size of the soda. I don't think we'll do that here. Let's hope not.
I think it's the size of the soda.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions?
Make a motion that we approve this variance, assuming the applicant will agree to the stipulations.
Okay. We have a motion.
Second.
For Mr. Noonan and a second. Any other questions or discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now we will move into closed session. Item, section six, report discussion action items, legislative update. I guess we're waiting for.
Good evening, I'm Jennifer Sizemore. I just wanted to go over two of the bills, unless you have questions about any of the other ones, that directly affect the board and the district. First is Senate Bill 450. We discussed that at our past meeting. That's the one that would have changed the requirements for the local health officer. We did introduce an amendment that would, originally the way it was written, it would have changed the qualifications to make it comparable to the state health officer, and we did oppose that because we thought it would really lower the qualifications for the health officer. So Dr. Madat introduced an amendment to really, we think, keep the qualifications current with standards across the United States. And one of the important things in it, and we think it'll help with the recruitment process as well, is it did change it. So now you can hire a chief health officer who is eligible to have a license. To get a license in Nevada and then get their license within 12 months, and that would take effect July of 2013. So just keep that in mind with the recruitment process. So we think that's a big win. So it passed the Senate and now it's in the Assembly side. And then the second bill is Senate Bill 315, and that's the one that would change the makeup of the board. There was a couple of amendments that went along with that, would have done certain things. It would have taken the unelected board members off. A couple of different amendments were introduced. At the last workshop, Mo Dennis went back to the majority leader, went back to pretty much his original bill. And what it did, it does add one new member to the board who would have a background in recycling. It did add term limits to the board. So now there are two-year term limits for board members. And it changed that general industry member so that it isn't a contractor or a member of a resort industry. So it did change the general industry member as well. But it left pretty much the board intact and as it is now. So those are the two ones I wanted to highlight today. I don't know if anyone has any questions.
Dr. Schick?
What was the motivation for the term limits?
I think what I've heard from some of the background I've heard is they think that it'll be good to have more turnover and different faces on the board. So that's really all I've heard about that.
So may I? So when you say two-year term limits, what I mean, does it, how many two-year term limits or two-year terms can you have based on this new?
One.
It just says, let me find it. Members of the District Board of Health serve terms of 2 years.
Could you repeat that, Jennifer?
Members of the District Board of Health serve terms of 2 years. Members selected pursuant to paragraph B of subsection 2 may serve for no more than 2 years.
Two-year terms.
Yes, sorry.
And that applies to the non-electeds, correct?
I think that applies to everybody.
Does it apply to every?
Well, I mean, I would be concerned about a loss of institutional memory by having a more rapid turnover. And, you know, the terms do expire, and mm-hmm. the person isn't, you know, if they're not productive, or if they're not.
And that's something we can certainly bring up when it's heard before the Assembly. Because I don't know if that's an issue, that's how important of an issue that is. But we can certainly bring that up. But one of the things we think is important, originally they were going to put two new members on the board. That did go back to one because we thought there should be a balance between the elected members and the unelected members. So there still is a majority of elected members on the board. There was going to be language in there that would allow the county and the cities to appoint anyone they wanted to the board, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be electeds. We thought it was very important that electeds were still appointed to the boards by the entities, and that language was changed. Committee members had an issue with that as well, so that language was changed back. So, you know, there were certain things that were preserved that we thought were important. So we did think it was good that, you know, we don't know that anyone wanted the board to expand, but we thought it was a win that only one member was added to the board.
Well, I mean, I would stand in opposition to term limits. I think it weakens the board. I think the whole purpose of the board is to provide oversight for staff, and with the more rapid turnover of the board, I think that oversight is weakened.
And we can certainly bring that up, especially if that's something that, you know, we can say that is something our board feels strongly about, if that's a position the board would like us to take.
Do we want to do that in the form of a motion?
I move that the Board of Health stand in opposition to term limits, and the concern would be loss of institutional memory the board members and for the board as a whole.
Okay, we have a motion from Dr. Nemec. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second from Mr. Jones. Your question?
Is that for elected and appointed, or because aren't appointed already 2 years anyways?
It is just appointed.
It is just appointed. Okay,
it is 2 years, but what they're saying is you can only serve two terms of two years.
Right. So it's a 4 year.
So it's a 4 year, two year terms. So, discussion? All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Okay, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other bills?
If I could just interject something, when I read the language, I think it's all the board members, two-year terms and two terms. So I don't think it's limited just to the appointed ones, but we can get that clarification, and I can send something out to you.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
I don't see it here.
Thank you.
Thank you for your help, Vice Mayor. Okay, now we move to board reports.
Madam Chair, we moved the CHO Succession Committee recommendation.
Right. Under the report. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
I had it written down. So we'd like to have a report from the CHO Succession Committee.
We did meet about 2 weeks ago now, and what we understand at this time is we have the one internal candidate who has identified himself, Dr. Coleman. We have one out-of-state candidate who continues to remain anonymous. We have one client who is interested in being in the pool if our recruiter, Pam Derby, could convince them that they may have some ability to remain anonymous up until a point of decision. And then a fourth candidate who is willing to be public in the process. However, through the recruiter, that fourth candidate does not appear to have the strength of background of the other three candidates. In meeting with the subcommittee, we did submit a group of questions. That set was really related to getting to know the candidate on a more personable basis. Second to that, through Dr. Madaw, and through Kelly Brinkus and through Pam Derby, Dr. Madaw had prepared some technical questions that could be a written response used in combination with a resume from the applicants for the purpose of getting a better handle on their technical and scientific medical background in terms of ability to do the job. Those questions, I believe, were going to be still vetted through Pam, Kelly, and Dr. Madaw, and maybe you could let us know any progress on that in the last week. Are we about finished with putting those questions together? Anybody know?
I'll let Kelly answer that for you.
Okay.
We met with Pam via phone and came up with what we thought might be a better solution to pare down the questions to a reasonable number. She already has some of the information via perusing the CVs and the interviews that she's done with the candidates. So we didn't want to be redundant and send questions that we already have the answers to. So at this point, she's going to separate out the questions that have already been answered via the CV and the interviews, and then we will take the remainder questions to construct the supplement that we are going to send out to the candidates for them to complete.
Okay, and you are also working on the group of questions that are the get-to-know-you type questions that might come later on in the process, or you'll deal with that?
Yeah.
When we are later on in the process?
Yes.
Deal with that later is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Okay. So that really is our state of affairs. I think direction that the subcommittee needs from the full board is continued guidance to go forward with candidates that are willing to be public and conduct some interview with those candidates to determine their suitability and then also determine their fit for how they might work within the health district going forward. So there are candidates that do not wish to be identified, and obviously they would not be a part of that interview process at this point in time. But those that wish to be known, such as Dr. Coleman and the other candidate who, through the recruiter, seems to be less than experienced, but still is a candidate, we could certainly go forward with interviewing those two candidates and see where we stand, and then bring that information back to the board.
Sounds like a motion.
Somebody makes that motion. One other thing before we get there, and we had discussed what is the reasonableness of conducting a blind interview with some candidates. Annette was going to talk to the Attorney General's office. It seems like that's not a reasonable thing to do. I don't know if you want to just discuss that.
Because of the open meeting law, once we as a board or a committee decide to interview a candidate, that has to be a public process. Now, the staff can certainly look at the CVs and vet and say, and rank them. You know, applicant A has this qualification and it's good for this, and applicant B has this qualification and it's good for that. But the moment we give you that information, the moment we give you the CVs, the moment you begin that interview process, that information has to be public.
And I think, you know, along with that, the subcommittee recognizes we don't want to do anything that looks like a behind the scenes process. It should all be upfront and no, in a sense, allowance for doing a blind interview at this point in time. So I guess the request for motion would be to the effect of interviewing those candidates that wish to be interviewed. And certainly through Kelly, send out the questionnaire to all candidates, all four candidates at this point in time. If anybody wants to make that motion, then.
You can make it.
Can I make it?
Yes.
All right, then I make it.
Second. We have a motion from Mr. Jones, second from Councilman Bateman. Any questions or discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Appears to pass. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for the report. The next section, Section 7, Board Reports. Do you have anyone with emerging issues or reports? Seeing none, we move to item 8, health officer and staff reports.
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is sort of ask you to give me guidance. I've prepared a presentation on One Health, and depending, it's an evening meeting, and it could be that if you would want me to delay that to the next meeting, I could be happy to do that, or if you've got the energy to go through. I actually found a PowerPoint that I prepared when I was in Florida about this. It's very interesting, but I can make it a 5-minute presentation or I can make it a 50-minute presentation, but if you could give me some feedback about that, I wouldn't be having my feelings hurt if we wanted to get out of here a little earlier tonight.
I every meeting has that same issue, so I would say it's worth our while since we're here and able to hear your presentation. Maybe a succinct presentation would be my recommendation.
Okay.
Do we have unanimity on that?
Yeah, like in the 20 to 25 minute, you know, Not so much the 50.
I'm Mr. Jones.
Not the five minutes.
Okay, well then, before jumping into that, because I do have a PowerPoint that I'll race through and skip through, I just wanted to mention that we had a tremendous success as a team with our own staff working with the State Health Division. And especially Dr. Coleman and Deb Williams and myself flew up and met in Carson City with the chronic disease program staff of the State Health Division to try to prepare the grant for chronic disease. And this is the competitive $1.5 million a year for five-year grant that I had mentioned to you before. And the initial efforts were between frigid and icy and sub-zero, but over the period of time, fighting very, very compressed deadlines, we got some thawing of the relationship, and to Mr. Richard Whitley's credit, he convened us for a second meeting, and our staff had sort of written a lot of the grant in the hopes that we'd be able to cut and paste at the last minute. And that's exactly what happened. And when we flew up there, I have to tell you, it was like popping Rolaids to try to figure out how's this meeting ever going to take place, and we're all going to be friends at the end of it. And we were able to do that, and the state submitted the grant. It's the first time in 4 years that they shared with us a full grant that they had prepared and submitted to CDC. It was a true team effort, and at the end of the process, we said, how come we haven't been doing this for 5 years? And this is the model by which we need to work together in the future. So truthfully, I will be devastated if we don't get funded by CDC, but the effort was clearly worth it in terms of the process and rebuilding a relationship with our colleagues at the State Health Division and also with Washoe County and Carson City. So that, I just wanted to let you know that it was a huge success for us. So with that, I'll jump into this presentation. Well, One Health is a new scientific movement. It actually has been around for decades, and it fell sort of off everybody's radar screen. But the whole idea was, with the changing world that we have and the emergence of global health threats and opportunities, emerging infectious diseases, and the importation of exotic diseases, it became recognized that maybe 70% of all the new major outbreaks of the last several decades have really been coming from animals, and those agents have crossed species into humans. And it's just been a wake-up call for all of the veterinary and medical communities, and also the environment. Now, I just wanted to share with you real quick some of these slides, because I tumbled into this website when I was in Florida. And what these guys did, and they're geniuses at Michigan and New Mexico and in England, and they spent years developing the computer programming to do what I'm going to show you. So here's the standard globe with the land area. And what they did is they were able to put dots on fixed points, and a million dots that are actually the borders of the countries. So they can elasticize the area that you see visually based on different parameters. So the last slide, there's the land area for a standard Mercator map. Here's where you visually see what's the population of the different countries. So you can see India just explodes, and South America gets smaller, and China gets much bigger. So now you can look at total births, and again, you can see that, I mean, the birth rate from India is just enormous, and also from China. So now infant mortality, again, I mean, India jumps off the map, as does all of Africa. You have maternal mortality, same thing. And you can see that in the Western Hemisphere, the area just almost disappears in comparison to the size of the impact of maternal mortality. You have HIV prevalence. And you know, you can just see how devastating that this disease is in Africa and also in India. And of course, now what's recently happening is the former Soviet Union. If you look at tuberculosis cases, they almost fit over the HIV. And that combination of HIV and TB is really causing millions and millions of fatalities. Malaria. I mean, it's just, malaria is one of the biggest killers of infants in of all of the diseases. And again, you can see the massive impact that is occurring in Africa from malaria. And then rabies, deaths. And I worked in Bangladesh, and I actually saw my first cases of human rabies. And it's just astonishing that some of these things are happening. And now here's aircraft departures. This is a massive, I'll give you the website, you can go on it. They have hundreds of these different maps to teach us about all kinds of things. But if you look at aircraft departures, you can see that the United States is the biggest group of flyers that they're around. And there's 21 million civilian aircraft departures every year, or 40 departures a minute. Close to a billion people fly every year, and at any instant, there's 60,000 people at 30,000 feet. You can see net immigration, and you can see the way that the United States has experienced such a huge immigration and how that's impacting on our country and on the diseases we're seeing. But we receive around 37% of the total immigrants that occur from all around the world. And during the past three, I mean, there's huge translocations of populations from the wars that are going on. I mean, during the past 3 years, more than 2 million Iraqis have fled Iraq and are expected never to return. And then just for a flavor, there's military spending. And the U.S. is the largest military spender, and we account for 45% of the world total. And our spending is 9 times more than the second place spender, which actually is Japan. And then I didn't know this.
Excuse me, that last slide. I assume that purple thing on the right is North Korea?
Japan. No, it's Japan. Yeah. And then prisoners. I didn't know this until I went on this site. But 60% of all prisoners in the globe are held in the United States, China, and Russia, and the U.S. has the highest proportion of its population incarcerated. And there's this website, it's called World Mapper, and when I call these folks in Florida, I talk to them, and they worked with our IT staff in Florida, and we did Florida Mapper. So we did the same technique, and Florida has 67 counties, so then we developed the same information and prepared all those reports. So what does this tell us? It says massive global health threats, that we have a global food supply, massive human and animal international travel, extraordinary speed of travel, so that anybody today can get out anywhere from the planet to anywhere else in the planet in less than the incubation period of most of the infectious disease of concern. So there's a greatly increased likelihood that we'll diagnose exotic diseases in our own backyard at any time. Now, you've heard of SARS. There's a whole new impact on healthcare workers, because guess who's getting impacted by all these new diseases? So in 2003, in the outbreak of SARS, there were about 8,000 cases, but 21% of the cases were in healthcare workers. And in Hong Kong, Singapore, China, and Canada, they had 667 cases, and 57% of them were in healthcare workers. And so in Canada, you can see that all the 45% of the cases there were healthcare workers.
What's the last group, Dr.
Mada? Nosocomial. It's hospital-acquired infections, so transmission within the hospital facility to, like, family, friends, guests, auditors, budget people, lawyers. Just a few random darts there. But here, when we go back and start looking at some of these diseases, Lassa fever hit in 1969 in Nigeria, and the nurses died and a lab worker died. Am I okay on time right now? What happened is that my boss and his colleague were flying back from South Africa, and their plane landed in Nigeria on their way to New York. and they heard about a white nurse who was dying in a little hut on the edge of the town. And so they hopped a cab and they drove over there, and indeed they found a nurse who was really, really sick and not doing well. So they used their CDC credentials and bludgeoned the airline into putting her on a first-class seat on their flight, and they landed at John F. Kennedy and admitted the nurse to Columbia, where she then infected three other healthcare workers, all of whom who died. And so here are the two of these hotshots, big guys at CDC, almost imported, and this was a viral hemorrhagic fever, and it turned out that the nurse survived. And there's a book called Lassa Fever. And there was a missionary in Glen Allen, Alaska, named James Pinio. And he was a family doc, and I got to know him and work up a couple of outbreaks. And it was his sister, Ruth Pinio, who was a missionary nurse, who was the person they brought back from Nigeria and who was admitted to Columbia. So then in Ebola in 1976, and they had 318 cases, 280 died, four nuns. I was an EIS officer at the time, and I was the second on the list to go there. And if Joe McCormick hadn't gone, I would have been the one that they sent on that. Had smallpox in Birmingham, England, and that was one lab worker died, and then Ebola in Zaire, and then Ebola again in Uganda. Now we have, again, we've talked about the massive changes in the epidemiology of these diseases, but they had these Eco Challenge event in 2000 in Malaysia, and they had 300 athletes, 26 countries. We had people from 29 U.S. states, and then we had cases in Australia, United Kingdom, France, Canada, United States, Brazil, and Uruguay, all from one ultra sport event. We have massive international travel, more than 50 million travelers to developing countries every year. 763 million persons crossed an international border in 2004, and 4 million became ill enough after their travel to seek care. And this is a friend of mine who works at CDC in the Division of Quarantine. But in 2005, we had every day 1.1 million visitors come through customs in the United States. Now, TB, we've talked about that a little bit before, but TB was totally neglected by the world from 1970 to 1990. No funding, not a lot of good strategy. There's recently a big review in the New England Journal about the complete failure of CDC and WHO TB control policies, which are now leading to a massive epidemic of TB and HIV resurgent, and of course TB's become resistant to multiple drugs. And for us, you can see now that beginning really in 2001, in the United States, the majority of cases of TB were actually from foreign-born persons who are bringing TB here, not getting infected here. And I mentioned about TB and HIV and the tremendous problem. And of course, we've talked about the fact of the developing drug resistance because of the failure of some of our treatment policies. So again, what does that tell us? A new world of global infection control, interdisciplinary collaboration, human, animal, and ecosystem health, and a need to integrate human medicine, veterinary medicine, and environmental science. Now, one of the things that we're seeing is this global economy and this massive increase in the global population. So I looked this up. They have great sites, world population. Just click on it. It'll blow you away. Year one, the global population was 200 million human beings. We got to 1 billion in 1804, 3 billion in 1960, 4 billion in 1975. We had 6 billion in 1999. 7 billion in 2011. 7 billion people on the planet. And every one of us is exothermic, right? We're 98.6. We're walking around on the surface of the planet contributing to global warming. In the United States, the population is now 315 million people. So,
freezing cold that covers the other side of the world.
So anyway, the One Health Initiative grew in response to SARS and Ebola virus and all these new diseases which have been impacting us, which we never even heard about in the past, primarily due to the globalized food supply, to the massive amount of travel, and to better detection of diseases that in the past people would just die and nobody even know what they died of. And so this effort is going to try to handle increased research, increased diagnostics, increased surveillance, more rapid response in the anticipation that we're just starting to see the impact of more and more infectious diseases that we're learning about and being able to diagnose. And I don't know if about when I went to medical school, I was taught that Giardia was a human commensalate that did not cause human disease. How wrong is that? And so there's probably 50 diseases now that we routinely conduct surveillance for here in the district that when I was in medical school, we didn't even know that they were there. And so this new technology is really challenging. The new threats are challenging, and we have to be a lot smarter in the future. And one of this initiatives is to get veterinary medicine and their expertise combined with human medicine and then with environmental protection. And when I was in Florida, everyone was really worried about avian flu, you know, bird flu. And the head state veterinarian I worked with, and she's very, very brilliant, and she's part of the development of the One Health movement. So we were all running around trying to figure out all the pandemic flu planning and how are we going to respond. She convened a meeting of her veterinary colleagues who have been studying avian flu for 40 years. And they all came to the room and they said, we have no idea why you medical guys are running around in a flap. We've been studying this virus and it can't cause epidemics in humans. And so they had a couple articles from Korean scientists published in Science Magazine saying exactly that. And sure, it's true that because humans are living with animals, occasionally there's a cross-species jump, and in those cases there's a high fatality rate. But they were saying, you're looking at the wrong thing. And so far they're right, because the H5N1 has not shown an ability to cause sustained disease and human-to-human transmission. So that's my quick story. I'm sticking to it. And it is a very exciting development for really the whole global ability to conduct surveillance and control diseases.
Thank you.
We think the district is positioned to be able to participate in that with our surveillance process that's going on here now?
You know, I was really thinking that it sometime in the next 115 days, I should probably travel to some of these sites in different countries in order to establish just how good their surveillance is. But no, these are exactly the kinds of things that we have developed, some of these systems, to help us identify unusual things as rapidly as possible and be able to collect the appropriate specimens to make diagnoses and to collect information about travel and to communicate that with our partners, both locally in other states and through CDC. And so there's no question that we're seeing, and I lived and worked in Ethiopia and Bangladesh and other places, so I've seen lots of diseases that nobody hardly has ever seen if they did medicine here. And just in the last year, I've had calls from docs with very unusual presentations of patients and be able to say, hey, have you thought of this disease? Because there's what test do you need in order to rule them in or rule them out? And the more we're getting, the better we're getting at doing this, the greater barriers we'll put in place to prevent disease spread.
I have a question. How much of this have we already experienced, because we have a large international population traveling to Las Vegas and then going back to their countries? So in our local system, how much have we seen?
Well, truthfully, that's why as soon as I got here, I went out to the airport. Jane Shunney took me out. Yeah, because my biggest question was, what are we going to do to control disease if we have it on an aircraft and we have 40 million people coming through the airport? And so there is a whole, actually quite sophisticated, global surveillance system that includes pilots having to phone in ahead of time if somebody gets sick on a plane and things. And you know, we as part of our preparedness have a whole plan related to how would we take care of people sick on an aircraft. And part of it is that Terminal 2 that they're talking about ripping down. And I'm glad it won't be my problem to figure out what to do with Terminal 3. But the deal is, because right now, if an aircraft came in and had to be quarantined, it would be taken over to Terminal 2 and isolated from everybody else at the airfield. And so we're in a discussion with McCarran about how we're going to take care of something like that if it happens in the future. And that's been part of our planning with UMC, who have 12 negative air pressure rooms, and then the spillover, and the VA has like 35. So we've got a plan that will work if we have one aircraft. It won't work if we have five aircraft in the same kind of thing. But these are all part of what this preparedness planning is. It's part of the Homeland Security grant for our surveillance program. It's part of the pod exercises that we're doing. And just as we honored Sergeant Lake earlier for his role, this is a team effort. And the isolation quarantine work that we did, we used 4 weeks ago. And the Henderson Police got Judge Voy's order. And they went to the home and they got this person who was getting on aircraft and ignoring everybody and flying over to Singapore and had multiple drug-resistant cavitary TB. And we got that person under treatment, and that system worked. And that infrastructure and procedures didn't exist 3 years ago. So we're building a lot of this system response and infrastructure as we speak. And you're the ones who are overseeing it and authorizing it and helping us make it all happen.
Madam Chair,
Councilman.
At the Las Vegas Medical District meeting, a couple of members of the public turned out who had retired from the health district in veterinary science. And listening to your presentation, I see clearly a research role for veterinary medicine. Is there a veterinary medicine role in the frontline provision of public health services, such as what we do here?
Well, we very much work with our veterinary colleagues here in the state. I mean, we just had a exposure of a rancher up near Mesquite to rabies, and we've got plague that's endemic here. We have West Nile virus, so we absolutely are just like everybody else, partners in the food chain of microbes and viruses and parasites that we have to be thinking about. And you know, we have endemic rabies in bats. And we've had positive bats on the Siena golf course and stuff. So, I mean, fortunately, a lot of these things are very rare. And fortunately, we have a system that can identify when some of these exposures occur that can enable us to respond very quickly. But when I was over in Africa, I didn't realize how I didn't want to be part of the food chain. But we all are.
I'd just like to add that, as I have to put a plug in, as a member of the Medical Reserve Corps, which is part of the health district, which is all medical volunteers, there is a whole veterinary section that will respond in addition to the medical volunteer program. They provide kennels and isolation of the animals and then exposure to people.
That's very important. And the other thing I didn't really mention, just because of time, is that, like, when these outbreaks of some of these diseases occurred in China, they killed 500 million poultry. Mm-hmm. I mean, the scale of these operations to feed this global population is staggering. And so, you know, the efforts to respond here have been very vigorous in different parts of the country. And you probably remember SARS, but what nobody that I know of in the medical field can figure out is, why did it go away? I mean, here was a new virus, human-to-human transmission, 8,000 cases, 24 countries involved, no antibiotic, and then it just burned out and went away. So the virus must have mutated, been unstable. But for that window, it was quite scary in how quickly it spread and the high fatality rate of those who got infected. So, again, that's why, you know, this investment we're making in surveillance and preparedness is well spent money.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you. That was
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the last thing I just want to share is we're working in EH on the pool reg revision plan. We want to have a white paper that we can bring back to you to show the stakeholders what's out there, how, why do we need a change, and what are the most important changes that we will need to go through.
So we have then the board officer nomination forms?
Yes, and they've been sent out. The nominations are done in July of each year, so you all should be getting one of these in your emails. We've also sent out notices to all the jurisdictions alerting them that their elected members need to be reappointed. And we've gotten a couple of responses back, but not everybody, but it's still kind of early in the season. It's just an FYI.
Tonight?
I'm sorry?
We could leave these with some person tonight?
Oh, certainly. I'm going to check.
Have we come to the end? I believe we have. So we have our public comment. We apologize that you've had to wait so long.
Thank you so much, and I do apologize, but...
You're ready,
Brian. Well, as I was saying, when I met Mrs. Daniela, who is the owner of Rincon Catracho, the place, the restaurant that is experiencing right now problems with the health permit. I know, and I'm glad that I was in a hearing because I could see the all the problems that they were facing. And since I knew that the problem, the permit was temporarily canceled, I contacted them and I said, well, count on me because I'm going to do my best to guide you and work on generating the manual and get all the trainings that we need and help all the employees, key employees, being certified because they need to know what they're doing because this is a big compromise dealing with food. As an accountant, nobody, you know, when I went to school, nobody told me about these issues. But when I'm working in the real life with clients and several type of businesses, this one particularly took my attention, so I did my best, and we generated a huge manual. It's this big, four videos that are coming from the, I think, a national well-known company that trains on OSHA and all their stuff. So tonight we are here because thanks to their invitation to stay here to me and speak on their behalf. And the first thing I want to say on their behalf is to please, they want to apologize publicly because they understand that they made a big mistake, ignoring probably because due to the English barriers that they don't understand pretty much very good, but it's not an excuse. I know ignorance is not an excuse. So they really want to express their apologies. And the attitude that they took when to the health department inspectors. They truly understand now that the inspectors and all the your crew were doing an outstanding job. And we understand, we are learning. We are in the process of learning. And so, but I know they are taking wide, deep steps in correcting all these issues. When I was in a hearing, all the problems, because they were several times, they got inspections. I'm glad that all those problems were pretty much the same. Temperatures and how to avoid in the cross contamination, storages, receiving. And I'm glad those things, I know, because I went through all the trainings with all the crew, and we already took care of those. We already trained and certified all the people that it's gonna be facing this kind of jobs. And also, just for reference, this corporation is right now employing like around 30 people, 30 families that depend on this job. And but also, there are two more projects that we are working with, opening those, so we're estimating another minimum 20 to 30 people more getting jobs in Nevada. Of course, we're paying all the taxes that we are required to, sales taxes, employment, and insurance, and all that stuff. And but mainly, besides to expressing our apologies. It's to request your help. We know we need to take the next step, which is the appealing the decision for that hearing. But we are here just to ask you if there is a certain way that you can help us to get the permit back on. We are just doing our best to resolve these matters. And I know at a certain point you might be able to help us. And ultimately, we are just here to let them know, the health department, that we are, whatever we have to do, we're just doing it. And whatever we need to do, we will improve it to make sure and guarantee that the way we are handling the food will be reflecting in the public health, because I know all of us are talking about this. So. I don't know if Joshua wants to say anything or. And also, before I forget, they will tell me, make sure to tell them. Well, they've been doing business for the last 10 years in Las Vegas. So in this kind of business, that's all what they do. That's the way they live, and they generate employment to these 30 families in Las Vegas. So I think it's nice to mention this, because we're struggling. Our economy is now fully recovered, so we're in the way, but. You know, it's just, I don't know, it should be taken into consideration.
Thank you. We can't really respond tonight. It's not on the agenda, but if Dr. Madoff, there's a staff person that could perhaps speak to him and.
Sure. Follow up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else who wishes to speak at this time? Our meeting is adjourned.